Thank you very much. So I'm most grateful to Stephen Morris for inviting me. And it's a great pleasure to be here. And I will present a work which is a little bit unusual. And this work was done in collaboration with Emmanuel Faure, who is my co-worker ever since the beginning of this work. Suzy Protier and Antonin Eddy did their PhD thesis on that subject. Julien Mouktar and Eric Sultan were PhDs, and the others were outside collaborators. So the main question in that talk will be, can any of the quantum phenomena be obtained in a classical system? So quantum physicists usually say no. And we were drawn into asking ourselves these questions because we found experimentally a system in which you couple something that looks like a particle with a wave. So the system is extremely simple. It is a bouncing droplet which bounces on the surface of a liquid and which couples to this wave on the surface of the liquid, and the whole thing becomes propagative. The droplet and the wave move together. So I will describe the basics of the experiment, and then I will investigate several situations where the droplet and its wave move straight, and that will permit to see what is the nature of the waves. And then what happens if they have an orbiting motion? And finally, what happens if they are confined within boundaries, if you pass them through slits, for instance? And in the end, I will discuss the relation of this system with ideas that were promoted at the beginning of the quantum mechanics history by de Broglie and later on by Bohm. So the system is extremely simple. You have a shaker here, and you have a little bath of silicon oil. And on this bath, on the surface, you deposit a droplet of the same silicon oil. And the shaker shakes the oil vertically. And typically, the frequency of shaking is about 80 hertz. The amplitude of the shaking is larger than gravity. And in such conditions, the drop bounces on the surface and doesn't merge with the liquid, even though these two liquids are identical. So I think, unfortunately, the talk has become a bit long, so I'm going to show you a part of what I usually present under the shape of films, and then I will return to my talk. So I will show you the basic phenomena. The first phenomenon is that the drop bounces. Okay, so this is a fast camera movie film, so it's slowed down by a factor of 20. The drop size is about 0.7 millimeter, and the viscosity of the oil is about 20 times the viscosity of water. And you see this is slow motion, of course, and you see that the drop bounces, and so why does it not merge? The reason is that between the drop and the liquid, there's always an air film. So the drop crushes the air film, but the air film doesn't have time to break before the drop is lifted again upward. So the air film is renewed, and therefore this bouncing can continue, and you can keep a drop bouncing in that state for days if you wish. Okay. So that's a very convenient experiment. It's actually the basic is easy. You can do it quite easily. This experiment, I must note, since there are many students in the audience, I should say that this experiment was started as a small project in Université Paris Diderot in third year of university. So it was a small project which lasted 3 months, and the student was lucky enough to find this new phenomenon with us during that course. So you see, an experiment can start. So just for the pleasure of the eye, as we say, I will show you what happens if you put several of these bouncing droplets on the surface. In which case you see this. Okay, so they emit waves, and since they emit waves, they couple together. And since they couple together, they form a little crystal, which is a hexagonal symmetry. And you see, you can keep it for some time. Okay, this is not what I'm going to describe. I could, it's a different talk. Now, a different phenomenon occurs if you increase the amplitude of the oscillation. And this is a different film. It's not a slow motion. This is in real time. And this shows you the cell, which is about 12 centimeters in size, from top. And when you shake the liquid a little bit stronger than before, this is what you see. You see, this is real time. So you see that the drop starts moving spontaneously on the surface of the liquid, and it is surrounded by a wave field. And you see that the drop bounces away from the boundaries without ever touching the boundary. And this is due simply to the waves that are reflected and that come back. Okay, this is the object that we are going to study. We called it a walker. So as you see, the drop and the wave are associated, and they move together. Okay, so the wall structure, the drop and the wave, we call a walker. So I will use that term in my talk. So why does it walk at all? So this is a slow motion of what happens near. So you see that the bouncing that you saw previously is slightly different because it has become asymmetrical. The drop bounces on the bump of the wave that it has created previously, but in an asymmetrical way. So this gives it a kick forward, and this repeats itself so that the drop moves at a constant velocity. This velocity is about a tenth of the velocity of the wave, that is to say about 1 or 2 centimeters per second. So it's not very slow. I just show you the same phenomenon as seen from above, and again, you see this asymmetry, of the bouncing. Okay, so this is a basic phenomenon. Just to emphasize the fact that you have a association of a localized drop with a spread out wave, this is a case where the wave is large, and you see that the drop is about 1 millimeter in size, whereas the wave field can have an extension of 10 centimeters, for instance. Okay, so this is the object that I'm going to study. Okay, so just again, something that I'm not going to discuss, I will show you for the pleasure simply. You can put 2 drops on the same bus and look at their interaction. So this is a collision of 2 walkers, if you wish. So as you have seen, they repel each other. Okay, that's one regime that you can observe. And I'll show you another type of collision, slightly different impact parameter. And this is what you see. Right. Yeah, it's always very successful. Okay. So now that I've shown you that there is some beauty in this experiment, I can proceed with the talk. Okay. So, as you have seen, there are several regimes of bouncing, and I can study them as a function of various parameters. So I block all the parameters. I always work with the same oil, with the same frequency, with the same air. And I only tune 2 things, the diameter of the droplets and the acceleration of the forcing. And this is a phase diagram of what happens. So below this threshold, the drop doesn't bounce, so it merges with the substrate. And above this threshold, there is a different phenomenon, which is very well known in fluids that are shaken vertically. It's the Faraday instability. So for those of you who have never heard of the Faraday instability, when it's a parametric forcing of the surface wave of the liquid. So when you pass the threshold, this threshold here, below this threshold, the surface of the bath is flat. Above this threshold, it is covered with a pattern of standing waves. Okay, this is Faraday instability is a parametric forcing. The only thing that is important to know about it is that the frequency of the Faraday wave is half the frequency of the forcing. in a way similar to what happens for a pendulum that you force parametrically. You force it at a frequency which is twice the frequency of the pendulum. Okay, so returning to this diagram, I'm going to show you what happens as if when the drop, when the amplitude of the forcing increases along this line. So if this is a spatial-temporal diagram, this time, this vertical line showing the bouncing of the drop. So this is the drop, this is its reflection in the bath. So you see that this is bouncing at the frequency of forcing. Now, above a certain threshold, this bouncing becomes unstable to a period doubling. So you have one big bounce, one small bounce, and so on. And then, later on, this period doubling becomes large enough so that the drop touches the surface only once in two periods. So it stays more time in the air, if you wish. And that's very important in this experiment, because you remember maybe that Faraday instability is also subharmonic. It's also at the half frequency of the forcing. So as a drop becomes as a subharmonic bouncing, it becomes a source of this Faraday wave. It excites these Faraday waves. And this is why the waves that are created are larger amplitude, and that's the walking phenomenon occurs in this region, which is, as you see, just below the Faraday instability. So in this region, the drop starts moving. This is due to the fact that the drop excites larger waves. So I will just... So this is a transition from standing drop to a moving drop. And we have a small model which explains why it moves. So it's a very simple model. It's a very naive model, if you wish. We sort of ignore the fluid dynamics of the problem, which is very complicated. We just say that the drop moves horizontally in the plane of the liquid. It's submitted to two forces. One is a dissipation force due to a shearing of air when the drop falls on the surface. And one is a motor force, which comes from the fact that the drop receives kicks oscillating surface. There are three seats here, if you wish. You don't want to stand. Come. there are many seats here. Unless you want to escape. So this is a model where you just look at the horizontal motion, averaging. There's still more. Well, okay. You just say that you have a force which is due to the kick received by the oscillation and by the fact that the drop falls on a slanted surface. And the slant is linked with the amplitude of the wave. So the larger the amplitude of the wave, the larger will the slant. And finally, there is a phase between the velocity of the drop and the velocity of the wave. So if this velocity of the drop is zero, then this zero, that means that the drop will bounce on the top of the wave and will not move. But of course, if it's not zero, so you seek solution, steady solution. So you write that this is not acceleration, the acceleration is zero. And you seek steady solution of this equation. And you find that, and then you expand the sign. So that gives you a first order term and a third order term. And you get this equation. So you see this nonlinear term is a bit strange because it's a nonlinear term that involves the ratio of the velocity of the drop over the velocity of the wave. But this being given, you have an equation, typical nonlinear equation for the velocity of the drop. And this equation has only one solution for low forcing. So this is a forcing parameter here. For low forcing, the drop doesn't move. And then there is a threshold over which the drop starts moving at constant velocity, at the velocity which is on this curve. It moves either to the left or to the right in the model. And this actually corresponds to what is observed experimentally, except that in experiment, the velocity varies with the size of the drop, because in fact, the amplitude of the waves depend on the size of the drop, which we didn't take into account in the model. So the model otherwise gives the right order of magnitude, both for the threshold and for the velocities. It has been improved recently by Jan Moracek and John Bush in MIT, and now they have quantitative agreement with our measurements. Now, just a remark. is that, of course, this system is a dissipative system. And so it's a sustained dissipative system. And the trick is that the system receives energy in both ways. Energy is provided to the drop because it's kicked up at each oscillation. And energy is given to the wave because of the Faraday instability. So you are very near the Faraday instability threshold, so there's energy given to the wave, provided to the wave. Okay. So now I'm coming to my talk, beginning of my talk, really, is that we have an object which is formed of a drop, localized, and a spread-out wave. And they are constrained in having this common dynamics because they move together. And the question is, how can they have a common dynamics given that one of them is spread out and the other one is localized? Okay. So we'll examine first a very simple situation when it's walking straight, which is when it's far from any obstacle, or any wall or anything. Then what happens when it's walking in circles? And then finally, what happens when it's confined? Okay, walking straight. So that's a little bit, it is a little bit technical, but it is needed for the rest of the talk. So okay, so you remember this phase diagram. This is acceleration. This is the same three pictures of the same drop when the tuning is in A, B, or C. So as you see, in the three cases, the drop walks more or less at the same velocity. But you see that the wave field is completely different. Here, the wave field is more or less circular. Here, it has some kind of horseshoe shape. And there, it has a complex structure. Now, my aim now is to understand this complex structure because it will be very important in the rest of the talk. So this structure you can measure. These are measurements of the shape of the surface by a technique introduced by Frédéric Moisy. If someone is interested, I can give details after the talk. So this is the shape of the wave field. And as you see, again, it has a complex structure. What is this structure? So to understand this, you must remember that the drop kicks the surface repeatedly, and so you must wonder what happens at each kick. So instead of, we try to look at what happens at one kick. So you don't use a drop because it moves all the time. You just take a small steel sphere and you drop it in the bath. Very simple experiment. The experiment that you do when you throw a stone in a pond. So this is a normal situation. You create a wave. You have thrown your ball here. You create a wave, and this wave propagates away and damps out away from the center. If you do the same thing in a bath which is vibrating near the Faraday instability, you see exactly the same thing. You have the same initial wave. You have the same front here and there, but behind this front, a pattern of standing Faraday wave is left, which is damped because you are below the Faraday threshold, but only very weakly damped. So it can sustain, it can remain there for seconds. Okay. So this is, in fact, the time of damping depends on the distance of Faraday instability threshold. So it's tunable in the experiment. So this is I will show you now this is the spatial temporal image, spatial temporal analysis of this line. You look at how this line of this picture evolves in time. So this is time going down, this is space, this is a standard situation without vibration with this propagative wave. And here you see that you have the same propagative wave leaving behind this pattern of standing waves. Okay. Now you can imagine that if you want to go back to what interests me, which is the wake of the walker, this means that each collision of the drop on the surface generates something like that. Okay, so in fact, we did a numerical simulation of this the wall phenomenon with Emmanuel Faure. And to do a numerical simulation, you have to simulate two things: the motion of the drop and the wave field. So the motion of the drop, you suppose that the takeoff and landing are fixed by the vertical oscillation, and you say that each time the drop falls on the surface, it will leave with a direction and velocity which is linked with the slope, local slope, of the wave. Now, how do you get the local slope of the wave? Then you have to compute the wave field. And the wave field you compute by, you know the past trajectory of the drop. And in all these points, the drop has emitted wave. So you have to superpose these waves, and you get an interference pattern, and you compute what is the resulting slope in that point where the drop is going to fall. And this gives you the next jump. So with this model, you can recover, you recover the walking threshold, and you recover this is a detail of the wave structure, but I don't really need to talk about that. You recover the walking threshold, so the fact that a motionless drop starts walking, and then you recover the shape of the wave field. This is the measured field that is simulated. So what is this structure? This structure is, in fact, an interference pattern, which is, so in France, we when we are students, we have to study the works of Fresnel, because Fresnel was a very great French physicist. And Fresnel, and you, in optics, you compute the Fresnel interference pattern, that is near-field interference, and for instance, behind a wall. So you have a wall, you shine plane wave, and you look at what happens behind. And to do that, you compute, you say that along this wall, not in the wall, but on the side of a wall, you have the plane wave that is similar to secondary sources of circular waves. And you compute what is the contribution behind, and you get something like this. And this is exactly what we have here. The wall is here, so that's the region that the drop has not visited yet. And here is the open space which, with sources aligned along this, this regime. So this is a Fresnel interference pattern. So it's very French. So you see the evolution that we saw previously is entirely explained by this. Here you have a short memory. Only a few collisions have contributed to the wave field. Here you have a longer memory, and here you have a long memory, so you, have to, you recover the Fresnel interference pattern. So that will be the most important part of my talk, which is you see this system as a wave field which remembers the past trajectory of the droplet. So in the case where it walks straight, you see it's rather trivial. It creates this interference pattern, and the droplet keeps moving, and nothing special happens. But you see that if the trajectory is not straight, then you will have the same rule of the game, and the interference pattern will become more complex, and will have a return force on the trajectory. And this is what I'm going to examine in the next. So this is the beginning of my talk, if you wish. Walking in circles. So you have to, so we wonder what happens if you have this wave field, and you force the particle to have an orbiting motion, a circular motion. So we have to find a way to convince the drop to move in a circle. So there are two ways you can do it. You can either use magnetic forces or Coriolis forces. So you could charge the drop, put a magnetic field, and the drop would be submitted to a transverse force. And then it would have a Larmor angular velocity and an orbit of this radius. Now you can alternatively put it on a rotating frame of reference, and it will be submitted to a Coriolis force, which is formally equivalent, and it will rotate in the rotating frame with a angular velocity 2 omega, omega being the rotating frame velocity. And it will have an orbit radius, so there is complete analogy. This analogy was introduced, in fact, by Michael Berry when he introduced a hydrodynamic analogy of the quantum mechanics Aronoff-Bohm experiment. Okay, so we were lazy, so magnetic field is a bit complicated because you have to charge drops and you don't know how to charge them in a reproducible way. So we chose a rotating frame. This is what we did, the experiment. You have the particle. It moves along a complex path if you look in the laboratory frame, but if you go back by computer computation, you show that in the rotating frame, it indeed has a circular orbit. So what is the effect of the wave on the circular orbit? So the idea is that that's classical expectation. The radius should decrease when you increase the angular velocity of the tank. If you have, so you do first the experiment with a particle, with a walker with a low memory, so a very localized wave field, in which case there is a slight shift, but it corresponds to the expected behavior. Now you repeat the same experiment by tuning up the excitation so as to have a long memory. So that means that all these sources will align on a circle, and you will have a complex wave field. And the result is you get discrete orbits. So not all orbits are possible. You have only certain orbits are possible. And when you increase the velocity, you jump directly from this orbit to this one, to this one, to this one. Okay? So you're an experimentalist, so you repeat the experiment changing the velocity, the angular velocity, the wavelengths, so all the things that you can change. And you can see that you can reconcile all the results in those units. So the radius of the orbits is scaled on the wavelengths. So this is what it looks like in the first orbits. So you see that indeed there is a recoiling of the wave field. So the wave field has a very specific structure. You see, this wave field results from the superposition of waves that have been emitted on a circle. You can compute that. And these are the two tightest orbit. So if you are very bold, which we are, you can wonder if this has anything to do with lambda quantization of an electron in a magnetic field. And, of course, it's very far away. It's completely different. You have an electron, you have a magnetic field, and you know that the possible orbits of an electron in a magnetic field are constrained by the Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization. And this imposes you this condition, which means that the possible orbits of an electron in a magnetic field have a radius which is given by this condition. It's quantized by a factor n here. So, of course, the problem is that you have h here. And, of course, we don't have Planck constant in the system. So, but the way around this problem is that to remember that in quantum mechanics, they have a wavelength. And we also have a wavelength. So instead of expressing this in terms of h, you express it as a function of the de Broglie wavelength. The de Broglie wavelength is this. So you can re-express this as a function of the de Broglie wavelength. You get this expression. Then you want to change from magnetic field to Coriolis situation. So you have to do this transformation here, this equivalence. And if you believe in the similarity, you should have the radii varying like this. Okay, so this is the result. So it works and doesn't work. So I will tell you why. So it works in the sense that the scaling is perfect, that you get the same idea of quantization of the levels. The difference is that the prefactor. The prefactor in that case is different. It should be a square root of 1 over pi, and in fact it's this. And this means that instead of having, as you have in quantum mechanics, the perimeter of the orbit is quantized, it's the diameter of the orbit which is quantized. But now we know why, and we know how to fix this, but this is still preliminary, so I'll keep it secret. So anyway, you can compute the whole thing. You say that you have sources on the circle. They all emit waves. You compute here the slope, local slope here. And what you find is that in that point here, the surface is slanted. And this adds up a radial force, which corrects the transverse force due to Coriolis force. And this modifies the equilibrium. And you by the computation of this secondary source, you find a good fit with the wave fields. And you find also that the dominant, all these sources cancel each other, except those that are here. And so, in fact, the only source that contribute to the slope here are the ones that are on the other side of the circle. And this is why you get this extra slope, which adds an extra force. And if you do the numerical simulation, you recover exactly the steps that are observed experimentally. And you can even compute them with a very simple model, even more simplified, where you say that you have only one source on the other side of the circle, and this will give you a very simple equation and a very simple fit of the experiment. Okay, so that was one part of the talk where I show that if you have past memory, the wave field, when you have a circular orbit, creates quantized orbits. Now I'm going to show you that you have a dramatic effect of past memory if you confine, I have to hurry, if you confine the system in closed cavities. So I will show you first what happens in the coral. I will show you the films. Okay. So this is the experiment. This is the white region is an underwater barrier, so that above this, in this region, there's only 1 millimeter of fluid. So the waves are damped. The water doesn't propagate in that region. Therefore, it's confined in this square. And this is what happens if it has no memory. Again, so it's very far from threshold, and that's more or less what you have seen at the beginning of the talk. The walker is repelled by the boundaries, and it has a sort of limit circle, very uninteresting. Now, I show you what happens in exactly the same experiment, just by tuning up the memory. And okay, so you see in this system, the drop is driven by the wave, and the drop generates the wave. If the drop breaks, the waves are gone. There's no wave in the cavity. All the waves that you see have been generated during its trajectory by the drop. But of course, this wave field is complex, and therefore, it creates a complex trajectory as well. And of course, a complex trajectory creates a complex wave field. So altogether, the system becomes chaotic. Okay. So that's okay. So this is what you have seen. This experiment has been done simultaneously by us in Paris and by John Bush in MIT. So we chose a rectangular cavity. You have a rectangular cavity. You manage so that the cavity is tuned at an eigen mode of the Faraday wave. So this is above the Faraday threshold. You have an eigen mode of standing waves. Now you put in this system a droplet and you let it move with this random motion that you have seen, of the type that you have seen. And you look at the statistics of presence along the axis of this cavity. And what you find is that the probability of presence of the droplet is linked with the antinodes of the eigen mode. Okay? And this is due to the fact that the wave generates, the drop generates waves, and these waves are sensitive to the eigen mode of the system, obviously. And therefore, the drop doesn't move so easily when there is an antinode because it has to move up. So it slows down. Okay. So I'll pass this because I'm in a hurry. This is also. You don't need. This you don't need. I will show you what happens in a circular cavity, the result that John Bush obtained. So in a circular cavity, you have a trajectory. These are results in a circular cavity. You have very complex trajectories of that type. You treat them statistically. And what you find, here's a better picture. What you find is that if you look at the probability of visit in the different region of the cavity, this probability has a structure which is corresponds to the eigen mode of the same cavity. Okay. Other experiment also with walls, single particle diffraction and interference. So you again the same question. You have localized droplet. You have a spread out wave. What happens if you have diffraction of the wave? The drop has to go somewhere, but where? Okay. So you have this cell, which is a square cell. You have a underwater barrier here with a slit here. You leave the drop from this corner. It walks toward the slit, passes through the slit, is deviated, and you measure the deviation. I won't show you the film because I don't have time. Okay, so you would see something like this. The drop comes near the slit, has a complex trajectory in this region because it meets reflected waves from the slit. So the trajectory is actually quite complex in that slit region, and the drop is deviated even before reaching the slit. In the slit, after the slit, and then finally recovers a straight walk. So you do what you do normally in diffraction. You measure the deviation, alpha, as a function of the impact parameter in the slit. And you try to make sense of, is there a relation between alpha and the position where the drop has crossed the slit? And when you do that, you find this diagram. So it's one case where you're very happy to see no correlation, because in fact this means that, so this is a deviation, and this is a position through the slit. So this means that if you cross the slit, at one point, you can be either deviated to left, to right, or go straight. So it means that there is a chaos, some kind of chaotic phenomenon that occurs. Now, what about the statistical properties? So you do a very tedious work, which is to repeat the experiment over and over again. And then, statistically, you find that the angle of deviation is related, on the average, to the diffraction pattern of a plane wave through the same slit. But it's, of course, you can notice it's not exactly like in the quantum mechanics, because in quantum mechanics it's linked with the intensity of the wave, of the diffracting wave, whereas here it seems to be linked with the modulus of the amplitude. So it's slightly shifted. But still, you change the wavelengths from one wavelength to the other, and you can see a clear change in the diffraction pattern. Okay, you do the numerical simulation. And in the numerical simulation, so all these effects are all linked with memory. You can repeat the experiment in the absence of memory, and nothing happens, nothing interesting. And the same thing is in the simulation. If you have memory, you can see that the deviation is very complicated, and you recover this histogram. So you see, the point is, it's not a surprise that the wave is diffracted when you pass it through a slit. That's quite normal. But this, we don't measure anything about the wave. What we measure is a particle trajectory. And what it means is that by passing the particle through the slit, because it's associated to a wave with memory, this gives an uncertainty to the system. You see, you have forced the drop to pass in a slit, so you have determined its transverse position, and because of that you have lost information on the direction of the velocity. So it's actually similar to an uncertainty principle. So of course you can then proceed to the next step, which is to do the double slit experiment. So the double slit experiment is interesting because Feynman said it was impossible, absolutely impossible, to explain it in any classical way. And furthermore, it's at the heart of quantum mechanics. So just to make this, for those of you who would not know, the single slit experiment in quantum mechanics is very paradoxical because you pass the particles one by one through a double slit apparatus, and you get interference fringes as if the particle had passed through both slits. And if you measure if you do measurements on the slits, then you see that it has passed through one slit, but then the interference pattern disappears. Okay, so I'm going to do the same. Okay, so you do this. You have two slits, and what you find is that if you do repeat the experiment over and over again, then you find that you have indeed some direction where it doesn't like to go, statistically. So the interesting thing is that in this case, you see clearly that the drop has passed through one slit or through the other. But you also see very clearly that the wave, associated wave, with all the memory, has passed through both slits. And because of memory, even before the drop has passed through one slit, the wave has been reflected by this wall with two slits. And therefore, the drop knows, so to say, where the slits are. And therefore, the trajectory is influenced by the two slits. So in a way, in the experiment, you recover something that looks a little bit like quantum mechanics, and that is completely, there's almost no mystery. I'm sorry to say. Okay, so tunneling through a barrier, I'm going to show you just a film. So that was an experiment that I proposed to Antonin Eddy, who was a PhD student. So it's just to show you that sometimes you have to do tedious experiments. So the idea was to put a walker inside the cavity and look at its probability of exit if the walls of the cavity were thin. So this is what you see if the walls are thick. So the drop moves, it is confined, and there it has no chance whatsoever to get out. So I repeat the same experiment, but in a situation where the walls are much thinner. And at first it looks the same. Okay, you get more or less the same type of cycle. You have a reflection, but you see that the waves leak out. Okay, so the fact that part of the wave moves out, does it give a probability of exit to the particle? Well, so you will wait, like the students did. And you see, it does go out. Okay, so it's very tedious because you have to repeat the experiment, you have to do as a function of the thickness of the wall and so on. But when you do that, you find that there is an exponential decreasing probability of exit as a function of the thickness of the wall. Okay, so how much? I will just show you some experiments that we are just beginning, so it's preliminary experiment. We look at the trajectory of these systems in a random medium. So you have small needles like this that you put in the bottom of the cell, and you look at the trajectories. And what you see, if you have no memory, is this. So you see the drop moving there. So it has some kind of random motion because it's still a walker, so it walks. And it's each needle is surrounded by a small meniscus and repels the drop, so it has this random motion. Now I show you the same with memory. First with weak memory. So at first it looks the same. There's also a random motion. But you will see that there are some differences. Like this. You see, it remains stuck. So it doesn't remain stuck very long, but it creates little circles like this. This is linked with memory. And if you increase the memory, then you get some kind of... So this is a trajectory in a case where you have a very strong memory. And as you see, every now and again, the system remains stuck. Then it becomes unstuck, and then it goes somewhere else. So we believe it might be some kind of Anderson localization. Okay, this is still in progress. Okay. So now I come to the art part. Is there any relation to quantum mechanics, of course? So... there's one thing that is clear in our system, that we have a particle which is driven by its wave. That's no doubt about it. And so, in fact, this has been imagined by people in quantum mechanics in the early days of quantum mechanics. And de Broglie was the first to introduce this idea of a pilot wave. So his idea was that because he knew that the particle was sensitive to boundaries that were far apart, he needed a system to make them sensitive, even though no force was directly applied to the particle, and introduced this idea of pilot waves. And so, in fact, there are now... Oh, yeah, that's a leftover of my talk yesterday. So, in fact, that now they're known as pilot wave theories. And they are very often identified to each other, but in fact, there are two of them. The one initial idea was de Broglie, and then it was taken over by Bohm in 1952, who did also a pilot wave theory, and now they are very often assimilated to each other. And in fact, they are very different, and I will show you briefly why. And so we'll start with the most recent one, which is due to David Bohm in 1952. So David Bohm started from the Schrödinger equation. So this is a Schrödinger equation. You do it what's called Madelung transformation. It was known since the 30s, where you write the wave vector under this shape, and you can dissociate the equation in two parts. One is a continuity equation, and a second equation concerning the phase. And if you do that, you can write the second equation like this. There is a Q, which is a quantum potential, and then ultimately you get an equation of motion in the real space, in the physical space. But the Bohmian approach is to solve the Schrödinger equation and then to compute from this Schrödinger equation trajectories. But these trajectories, in fact, since you started from Schrödinger equation, Schrödinger equation deals with probabilities. So the trajectories that you get from Schrödinger equation are trajectories of probabilities, of maximum of probabilities, of minimum of probabilities, whatever. And so that's why de Broglie wrote, when Bohm published his theory, that it is very different from what I had in mind. And I will tell you why. So de Broglie had in mind in his original model was that there was the wave in the real space was accompanied by a standing wave that would move with the particle, and that all its behavior would be linked with this motion of the particle accompanied by its... Do you say accompanied in English? Accompanied, sorry. I thought it was wrong. Didn't sound right. Okay, by its wave. And so he had the first problem, which is the first problem is that you have to have a standing wave around the particle. So to have a standing wave, you have to have a wave emitted by the particle plus a wave traveling in the other direction. So it is a little problem because you have a wave going out from the particle and then a wave coming from infinity to converge to the particle. So we would say it raises interesting philosophical issues. But in fact, in our system, it's not so surprising. We have a standing wave, and it's not so surprising because you have the drop emits a traveling wave moving out, but the outer front of the traveling wave emits a wave moving in. And that's why we have standing waves in the medium. So it's not entirely impossible to have a standing wave. Okay. So then the sort of idea of de Broglie sort of crystallized in this idea that there were two solutions. One, so he said there should be two waves, what he called the first solution. So he said the first solution is a wave associated in the physical space with the particle and moving with the particle. Second solution, so this wave, has a, he says, it has probably a singularity in its core, and in any case, is nonlinear and a large amplitude in its core. The second wave is a smooth wave, and it's a Schrödinger wave. It gives the probabilities of visit and so on. And he said the two ways should coexist. Okay, these are the details. So in fact, if you look through these eyes to our experiment, in a way, we have realized this system of that type. If you look, this is the diffraction experiment. You see that you have the droplet with its associated wave, and the droplet moves with its associated wave. So that's the first solution of De Broglie. But if you look at the probabilities of diffraction behind on the screen, it looks as if you had a plane wave impinging on the slit and being diffracted. So this is somewhat similar to Schrödinger wave. Now, similarly, if you look at the cavity experiments, at any given time, you see this particle with its accompanied by its wave, moving with it, which has nothing to do with the visibly with the eigenmode of the cavity. Yet, if you do the statistics, you find a different wave, which is linked with the eigenmode of the cavity. So this would be the first solution of De Broglie. This would be the second solution of De Broglie. Okay, so it's time to conclude. Returning to the, of course, the experiment has nothing to do. For young students, it's important to say this experiment is not quantum mechanics. It has a macroscopic scale. It has no Planck constant. It's two-dimensional. The system is dissipative. It's sustained by forcing. Furthermore, you have a fixed frequency. That's a problem. And the worst problem is that the waves propagate on a material medium, and there is an ether in the system. So that's not very kosher from the point of view of quantum mechanics. Now, on the other hand, you can be optimistic and say the main interest in this experiment is that it is not quantum mechanics. And because in quantum mechanics, you can only do experiments, they're all limited by Planck constant. And you cannot do non-intrusive measurements. All measurements in quantum mechanics, and this is well established, are intrusive and disturbing. Now, in our experiment, we can do either intrusive experiment, or non-intrusive measurements, because light doesn't interfere with the phenomenon. So you can look at the phenomenon and look at what happens, and you can even look at what happens during intrusive experiments. So let me be precise about this. Suppose you look at the slit experiment. If you only have means that are on the scale of the phenomenon, suppose you have only walls, droplets, and capillary wave to make the measurements. There's no way you can measure things without intrusion. Okay, so we have done such experiments. We have put walls. We have sort of tried to localize the particle with the result that we got an uncertainty on the velocity. Okay? But we can look at what happens during this intrusive measurement. And when you look, you see that the intrusive measurements, because the waves are reflected from the boundaries, creates zones of chaos. During the transfer through the slit, the drop has a chaotic motion. And this chaotic motion, we believe, is responsible for the probabilities that we observe. So in that case, it would mean that the statistics in quantum mechanics could have an underlying chaotic phenomena. I must, maybe a comment is that, you know, that there has been a lot of work on chaos in quantum chaos. Now, the people who have worked on quantum chaos have worked on quantum system given by the Schrödinger equation. So this quantum chaos is downstream from Schrödinger equation. The idea is here is that there's a possibility of chaos upstream from and producing the phenomena within Schrödinger equation. Now, my last slide is that all these observed phenomena, all the quantum-like phenomena that we observe, are all linked with what we call this past memory, wave-mediated past memory. Let me just remind you, just in case someone has slept all the time, that what we mean by that is that in the wave field, in the interference wave field, is recorded the trajectory, the past trajectory of the particle. And to our knowledge, there is no theoretical model based on this idea, except maybe Feynman's diagram, which indirectly, in an abstract way, have some kind of idea of that type. Okay, so for this reason, we believe that it would be worth revisiting objects that have this kind of wave-mediated memory. They don't need to be droplet walking on a liquid surface. You could imagine abstract models where you have this same characteristic that could be worth investigating. Thank you very much.